Oh, it's the New Books in Hollywood podcast.
Hi, it's Alan Salkin from New Books in Food. Today, I'm interviewing David Sutton, David E. Sutton, Professor David E. Sutton, author of Secrets from the Greek Kitchen, Cooking, Skill, and Everyday Life on an Aegean Island. I'm looking forward to this conversation because I am a bit of a Hellenophile myself. I enjoyed the book. And so we've got David on the line here. Hi, David.
Hi, thanks for having me, Alan.
Professor Sutton. You're a professor of anthropology at Southern Illinois University. You've also written Remembrance of Repasts, an anthropology of food and memories cast in stone. Oh, sorry. Anthropology of food. And you've written Memories Cast in Stone, The Relevance of the Past in Everyday Life, and you are the co-author of Hollywood Blockbusters, The Anthropology of Popular Movies. So you've been looking at Greek cooking for quite a while. How'd you get into this gig?
Well, I guess it goes back to when I was a kid and I was fascinated with Greece. It started with Greek mythology, reading that as a child. And then I had the tremendous good fortune of going on a study abroad program that was held on the island of Kalymnos, which is near Turkey. It's near Kos and Rhodes.
Is it near Forni?
Yes.
I was on Forni. This is going to be the problem during the interview. I'm going to reminisce about Greece.
That's all right.
Of course, Forni, their specialty on the island restaurants is lobster spaghetti, an unforgettable dish.
Right. Yeah, well, seafood is a big part
of it. Nothing will grow on Forni, pretty much, or nothing grows, I should say that.
That's very similar to Kalymnos. It's kind of like barren rock for the most part, although they do produce amazing figs and citrus, but they've been very oriented toward the sea. They're famous as the island of sponge divers, and that was their main occupation for most of the 19th and to the mid 20th century. I went on this study abroad program, which was being done on this island because the person who organized it felt this was a place where kind of Greek traditional life still existed. And I got an opportunity to at a young age, interact with Kalymnians and get a sense of both their deep sense of the relevance of the past to the present, something which I felt was very lacking in our kind of everyday U.S. consciousness, and also the power of food to bond people together, but also to evoke memories. And I was a kind of kid growing up in New York City. I cared a lot about food. It wasn't such a popular thing at the time, so mm-hmm. to kind of enter.
Did you have Greek food growing up?
I did. I had some friends of my parents who were Greeks and who cooked things, and always kind of got me excited. And then I think we got a Greek cookbook when I was a teenager, and so I started to try different things, and so the kind of whole package of culture attracted me to Greece, and when I went to Kalymnos and actually spent time with people, because we were apprenticed during the daytime to different workplaces or families, that's when it really connected to me, and I just wanted to go back there. Or have a reason to go back there. So that's what got me started. When I did my my PhD research, kind of the idea of studying food was not very common in anthropology. It was, it's not that it wasn't done, it just wasn't kind of on the agenda, certainly not of my professors where I studied. And so my main interest was in trying to understand this kind of historical consciousness in Greece and kind of what the past means to people, not as an abstraction, not as something that you learn about in books and things like that, but as a part of people's everyday lives, a part of their rituals, a part of all kinds of practices.
So the book is called Secrets from the Greek Kitchen, but you know, in some ways, I think the kind of underlying thing being examined is this question of tradition. What is traditional? How important is it? You know, when does tradition start? when there's something about, just like your instructor who first brought you, or the person who first brought you there, wanted you to see what they believed was more traditional Greek life.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, when did they start making lobster spaghetti on Forni? I mean, right. When did spaghetti come? When did the tomatoes arrive?
That's
what
right.
What is traditional? And I mean, I know the Venetians were very, a powerful force in the Aegean. But then again, pasta didn't even. Anyway, there's a whole other. That's a whole the history of pasta in Italy, and how does that relate? So
that's right.
But that said, as I've been going to Greece for the last 20 some odd years, it seems like there still is a nice sort of fountain, creating, the old Greek ladies who are, still getting their bread at the bakery every day and still living something like a traditional life. But I know what I'm talking about, but it's
even getting their bread at the bakery, they kind of look back to the days when they used to make the bread themselves.
And right.
So, tradition is always kind of 20 years before. Tradition is always kind of thing that people debate over, and maybe for different reasons, sometimes political reasons, certain traditions will be emphasized and others forgotten. And yet, mm-hmm.
Is there something being fundamentally lost that is the thing that we love about Greece that I mean, listen, I hear they were sponge divers 100 years ago. Mm-hmm. Was life better when they were sponge diving? And by the way, is there anything? There's probably nothing we can do about it. I mean, these are all giant questions. But are we at some breaking point now where whatever it is that's particularly special and unique is at risk of being lost, or is that just me with my own prejudices?
It is a really tough question, and I tend to be optimistic because I've been going to Kalymnos now for, from the time I went on that study abroad program, it's been almost 35 years. And so I've seen a lot of changes on Kalymnos. I remember when the first video stores opened up on Kalymnos. Of course, those are all gone now.
Yeah.
but I also see the continuities and the kind of thing that you're talking about, I think, that matters to people is very much still in play, even though people on the island themselves have these worries. They talk about the younger generation doesn't cook anymore. They say things like this. They worry about how to balance what they see as the advantages of traditional life with the advantages of what they label as modern life. But I think that, as I say, I see the continuities, and ultimately, in terms of how people live their lives, food still matters, and taste still matters, and cooking
yes,
still
matters. Yes, taste. You spend a lot of time talking about taste.
Mm-hmm.
Discuss and, that. What's
yeah,
what is taste?
And this was something that it took me a while to come to understand that taste matters in a kind of everyday way to people. It's not that Kalymnians are foodies as we would define them in the U.S. Or maybe they were foodies avant la lettre, but they're not snobbish about it. They're not using taste as a way of creating class distinction. They simply have always felt that that food is such a basic part of your life and such a daily part of your life that it should be a pleasurable part of your life. And so that means that taste matters to people, and that people are constantly discussing how to produce that good flavor that they associate.
Give an example of one thing specific, one dish or one flavor that they're looking for or that is discussed a lot.
It's ubiquitous in everything. So they'll talk about how to produce a proper octopus stew, and they'll have debates about whether you extract the seawater from the octopus first and then add salt to it, or you keep some of the seawater and use that to salt the octopus. And these kind of small issues are very important to them. I mean, the thing that really struck me when I started living on Kalymnos to do field work, I went there in 1992 with my wife and 6-month-old son. We were planning to spend 18 months on the island, and it seemed to us, coming from the U.S., that after a couple of months, that the dishes seemed very always the same. That people would always make, you know, this dish on this day, and it was always the same rotation of dishes, and it had a certain number of seasonings, parsley, garlic, onions, but nothing really out of the ordinary. But within that, what seemed to be sameness to me, there were for Kalymnians myriad differences based on all of these things, whether you used salt that you had collected from the sea, or you used table salt, where you got your olive oil from, endless debates about the merits of different olive oils. All of these things, once again, that we might associate with foodies or with upper middle class discourse in the U.S. was part of a very ordinary working class discourse in Kalymnos. And so I really began to see that what I had come to be enculturated and to expect, that, you know, one day you eat Italian and then the next day you eat Chinese for variation, was a very American way of looking at things. And what was the power of this tradition was that yes, from the outside it seemed like it was the same, but from the inside it had a tremendous richness because you understood all of the nuances of it.
Do you think that the obsession with, you know, every little variation, particularly in Kalymnos, is almost like a way of avoiding, discussing, you know, the real problems of life, you know, whatever, impending, you know, modernism, economic collapse, or, you know, whatever, dying, you know, the way that almost if you look at, you know, The Sun Also Rises, instead of talking about, you know, his war injury, he wanted to talk about the cold bottles of wine in the river.
I think that I wouldn't see it in terms of a kind of deferment of other issues, because people do talk about those issues. In fact, they're extremely articulate about both kind of issues about life, and that's when I talk about their historical consciousness. They're very much aware of change and the life cycle and politics. They are always talking about international politics. But I think that the thing that is true is that Greece has been through so a very traumatic history. No matter kind of where you cut that history, I mean, even if you only take the last 200 years, it's been extremely traumatic and some horrible things, including the real devastation of World War II. I mean, the Nazis really literally destroyed everything in Greece during World War II. Before that, there was the Asia Minor disaster. So many things like this. And so there's always kind of this sense of drama and tragedy in Greece. But at the same time, that's balanced with a sense of enjoyment and pleasure and finding that pleasure in life, being able to wrest that pleasure out of life. So I think that's where it comes in. It's not a deferment as much as a kind of a recognition that if you take pleasure in those everyday things, it will allow you to go on.
Well, that's one of the great things about visiting there, isn't it?
That's right.
And also, I would imagine you can discuss, you know, global warming and everything else just on the flavors of olive oil. I interviewed a woman from Lebanon who was talking, oh, the olive oil was better when I was a girl. Well, was it? I don't know. Maybe.
That's right. That's right. Absolutely. And I heard very similar things to that in Kalymnos. And also, more recently, I've been looking at how people use food to talk about the crisis, the economic crisis going on now in Greece, both in terms of how they've maybe changed some of their practices in relation to the economic crisis, but also how food becomes a metaphor for understanding the crisis, the most famous being, when the government ministers were talking about kind of what went wrong, I think in England they said, well, we all benefited and now we all have to suffer. And in Ireland, the minister I heard talking about it said, well, we all partied. In Greece, the vice president at the time said, well, we all ate the money. And that led to a debate about who actually ate the money and who didn't get to eat the money. So that metaphor of food and eating plays into that understanding. And then when the crisis really broke out and there were a lot of protests back in 2010 and 2011, one of the main forms of protest was to throw yogurt at government ministers. And I spent a lot of time actually thinking about, you know, why yogurt? I mean, what is involved in that? I mean, in the U.S. we throw pies, or we used to. In Iraq,
now we make our pies out of shaving cream, actually.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. The baseball players do that too. And in Iraq, the journalists threw a shoe at President Bush.
Yeah.
In Greece, they threw yogurt. Why yogurt? Is it just that they happen to have a lot of yogurt around to hand? Well, as I thought about that and as I talked to people about it, I began to realize that yogurt is one of those foods like olive oil, like feta cheese, which really represents Greekness. And the government ministers who brought the IMF bailout of Greece, which has been such a disaster for the Greek economy, were really seen as doing something anti-Greek.
Yes.
Had lost their Greekness. And so by literally covering them in yogurt, people were symbolically saying that we're going to remind you of your Greekness with this act of protest. So
is this an article or a book you're working on?
Maybe both.
I love the sound of it. When I was on back in the Olympic year, excuse me, back in the Olympic year, I was staying on Naxos, and there was the guy who ran the bakery in, you know, Hora, the main town there, or I think it was called, I can't remember if it was called Naxos or Hora there, probably Hora. Uh-huh. And, you know, he opened a drawer which was full of drachma coins, you know, and, you know, was insisting things were better and this is the real Greek money. And, you know, I personally can't disagree, because back when it was on the drachma, Greece was more affordable for us to go to.
That's right.
So I think it's very interesting what you're saying, literally covering them in yogurt.
That's right. And
of course,
I think
now most of the Greek yogurt's being made in upstate New York.
You're thinking of Chobani?
Mm-hmm.
Which is, I think the guy who owns it is Kurdish, but he markets it as Greek yogurt. Yes, you're right.
A whole other issue, which is the fact that you with me?
Yes.
Okay. The fact that the Greek yogurt in Greece, the fahe, however you say it, is better in Greece than it is here, and also, it's hard to get anything other than cow's milk Greek yogurt in America, which is very frustrating to me.
That's right, because one of the real pleasures is that there are all these local small producers and cooperatives in Greece that would make those yogurt in those little white cups with no markings on them, and this was how many people enjoyed their breakfast. And it could be cow's milk, it could be some combination with sheep and goat's milk. It would have a little bit of a kind of the skin of the milk on top of it that you could eat or take off. It's definitely one of the pleasures that I miss being here.
I've been telling people for years, you know, about, even because I first went in college and 87, maybe it's 88, something like that. And I was on Crete. Mm-hmm. And it just changed my whole way of, you know, how people dealt with food. And just the simplicity, but the quality. You know, it's what everybody supposedly knows now, but they still really do get it right in Greece, in my opinion.
That's right. And I feel like it's kind of, once again, they kind of proceed. I'm sorry?
They care so much about it.
They care so much. That's right. And they care so much about the provenience of their food, that they know where it comes from, that they have some sense about who produced it. That's all part of the knowledge that makes food sociable and makes it memorable and makes it flavorful. I mean, so that they're very much kind of, we're out in front of Alice Waters and a lot of...
Well, it's like so many things in America of, like, we had to reinvent it all ourselves, and then eventually we come back to realizing, oh, there was a reason. You know, the thing about Greece, despite the many, traumas the country's been through, is, you know, they kind of figured out what they liked something like 5,000 years ago, and they've kind of stuck with it.
That's right. That's right.
So you've written a lot of books and articles and stuff. What in this particular book, and just to remind people who for some reason would have started a podcast in the middle, it's Professor David Sutton. It's his book, Secrets from the Greek Kitchen. This is New Books in Food. I'm Alan Salkin. That's Secrets from the Greek Kitchen, Cooking Skill and Everyday Life on an Aegean Island. What's unique about this book?
Well, thanks. For putting it that way, because I think that this book was it was a real pleasure for me to read to write, because it was a real in some ways it was a real departure from my previous work, even though I've been writing about food. In the book Remembrance of Her Past, I tried to look at this question of why is food so important to memory in Greece, so that people would say to me, here, eat this so that you remember Kalynos. And that kind of direct connection that they made kind of tipped me off to thinking about, you know, well, what is this connection of food and memory? And realizing at the time when I was thinking about that in the late 1990s, anthropologists hadn't really looked at that issue. And so I tried to look at some of the ways that food was integrated into ritual practices, especially memorial practices for the dead, where food plays a very important part, and also into kind of everyday exchange practices, which was part of kind of building up a reputation for generosity, which is one of the primary values in Greece, this notion of philoxenia, love of the stranger, which goes very deep in Greek culture. And also trying to think about what the relationship between sensory experience and memory was.
People don't realize that even hospitality is, there's places that are better to visit than others. You know, just because Caribbean islands are beautiful doesn't mean they're very much fun to visit if the people don't really want you there. And you, one almost never feels that in Greece.
That's right. That's right. And I think there are really interesting reasons for that, which anthropologists spill a lot of ink over. But with this book, I think that my big departure with this book was that that I realized that if I really wanted to understand everyday food practices, I should use video to try and get at some of the stuff that was going on, because I always just kind of talk to people, observe things, you know, traditional anthropological methods. But once I introduce video and introduce it carefully into with people who I'd known for a long time already, so that they kind of trusted me, It opened up a whole realm of inquiry and a whole realm of data, if you want to put it scientifically sounding, that I didn't have before, at getting at how people do things and kind of the cultural way that something like cooking is shaped. And so this was a real revelation to me. I think that other scholars had looked at the kitchen as a place where a lot of interesting stuff was going on in relation to female power or possibly female oppression or just gender relations in general. But people had, for the most part, approached it once again through language, that is, what do people talk about while they're cooking, or what do people talk about in the kitchen? Certainly that's rich, and that's part of what I looked at as well. But going beyond just the talk to the doing and the choreography of the doing was just really fascinating to me, and hopefully to the readers, because along with this book, I set up a YouTube channel where I provide about a dozen videos, some fairly short and some up to about 30 or 40 minutes, of different people on Kalynos when I've presented my research with these videos, audiences really respond to them. I think they're very engaging, and I would hope that you don't have to buy the book to look at the videos. You can they have them on the University of California Press website. So I would encourage anybody.
What's the exact URL?
If you find my book Secrets from the Greek Kitchen on their website, they have a little tab that says videos, and it gives you all of the dozen or so videos that I have there.
UCPress.edu, and then search for Secrets from the Greek Kitchen.
Right, and it just allowed me to think about a lot of things that I hadn't before, and especially I spend a fair amount of time in the book looking at cooking tools. Everything from rolling pins to can openers to the fact that Greeks cut most things not on a counter but in their hands, and really to think about how some of those techniques, like cutting in the hand rather than setting something down on the counter, is equally a kind of cultural technique. It's a part of a larger culture, and it's not something that that we should treat as something universal. I really struck, for example, the series on Slate.com, You're Doing It Wrong, where they tell you how to prepare different things properly. And the person who does it isn't as bad as I think some places like Cook's Illustrated, which is really prescriptive. But they still had this sense. They had one up recently, how to cut an onion. And the woman said, you know, I'm going to show you the right way to cut an onion, the way that is most efficient according to chefs and experts. And I thought, well, nobody cuts an onion like that in Greece. So are they all inefficient? Are they all doing it wrong? That was the kind of issue that I started to think about, and started to think about, as I said, how something like cutting an onion could be a cultural technique and could use the insight of anthropologists to explain some of the differences.
It's fascinating because, yeah. It's one of those things that almost makes you realize why we're all feeling such pressure all the time about everything. Yeah, there's a right. You're totally right. They act like there's only one way, and this is the right way, and it's almost like what you're describing, having your hand, you know, it's almost a way to experience the food even more as you're preparing it.
I think that's exactly right. That there's a kind of intimacy when you cut everything holding them in your hands, when you use the experience or the feeling of your hands to create the kind of balance and tension that we typically use a counter or a cutting board for. It's a very different, more sensual experience, more intimate.
Cutting right into the pot, in other words, you're sort of the people will stand right over the pot with a small knife probably and an onion and just almost like a witch's brew or something.
That's right, and in some cases, one of the things that I really concluded about it, aside from the sensual aspects, is that it's a much more social technique for cooking, because you don't have to be standing up, turned with your back to everybody, bent over a counter. You can actually be sitting down with maybe a bowl in your lap as you dice potatoes, and have a conversation, or watch what's going on. And since so much of food preparation takes place during the morning and into the early afternoon, when lots of other things are going on, it's a way of remaining socially engaged with your environment at the same time that you're preparing this
meal. Has nobody written about this before, the cutting board versus the hand, this kind of thing?
Not that I could find. If I'm wrong, I'd love to hear about it.
Well, like you said, with the, you know, there was no such thing as really this study of food in this intellectual way when you started. I mean, you know, I've spoken at NYU's, you know, Fells Library, and, you know, there's food studies programs now, and it is such a new field, and yet it's like a lot of things. Once you get into it, you realize it's kind of everything.
That's right. That's right. And yes, it's so rich, and it seems so obvious kind of looking back, but when I started this, I remember one of the first times I presented, the first presentation I ever did on food and anthropology, when I was first thinking about food and memory, I presented it at Oxford, and one of the Oxford dons' response was food and memory. Why would anyone want to remember anything that they had eaten?
Well, that's especially true if you're British.
That's right. So but at the same time, when people not just from Greece, but from Greece, from Italy, from Mediterranean countries, they instantly kind of latched onto it and said, you know, you're onto something there. And so I kept with it, and I think that it's just such a rich field. And because food connects so many different things, the sensory, the social, the political, gender, family relations, it really is a great focus for getting at many, many issues.
Something I think you talked about is the sort of, I don't know, the standardization of Greek food, almost, you know, ideas coming from Athens. Is there some danger of losing the island variations?
In some ways,
or is this back to my original question about what is tradition?
I mean, in some ways, I suppose there is a danger in the sense that people are more willing to experiment now with Greek food, or with variations on Greek food, in the broader sense that they don't look just to Kalymnian traditions, but as you say, to a kind of larger Greek food. For example, people on Kalymnos didn't used to make melinzana salata, which is the Greek version of baba ganoush. One said she first saw that when she was visiting a friend on Rhodes. And she thought it looked like vomit, and it was at a wedding. But then she decided to try it, and eventually incorporated into her repertoire. So I think there are kind of a lot more sources, and one of the things that I talk about in the book is food TV, the Greek version of food TV, and kind of what influences that's had. But still. I don't think that there's a threat of local food going away. In some ways, local food is getting renewed appreciation because you can now market local cuisine. If you went to Greece 30 years ago, you know, there would be just a standard Greek restaurant. There might be some better or some worse, but now you kind of expect wherever you go. And certainly,
yeah, there's signs out front, you know, typical, I was on Ikaria, typical Ikarian food or something.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. And so some of those wonderful differences in local cheese manufacture, pasta, and the seafood dishes that you mentioned, all of these things are kind of getting more play. I'm not as worried about that. In terms of kind of whether the younger generation will keep up the tradition, this is one of the things that I spend a lot of time on in the book, kind of what's the relationship between the older and the younger generation in terms of cooking. Because I think there's this idea, one of the kind of myths we have about tradition is that it's simply handed down from one generation to the next, as if it's kind of like some piece of property that you actually can put in somebody's hand. Whereas what I try to show is that tradition, I think, has always been more dynamic than that and has always been kind of created out of all of the often conflicts between generations. And the fact that on Kalynos I found mothers almost never wanted to teach their daughters cooking or to have their daughters kind of take over in the kitchen. So there was none of this kind of passing from mother to daughter. You learn cooking in much more indirect ways, which were anthropologically much more interesting, I think.
Mm. People don't realize that there's now Eataly's in Italy, because in Italy it was always hard to get stuff from, you know, two cities away. And there, the Italians are lining up to get stuff from the south or the north or wherever they're not. I wonder almost if there's, you know, a Greekily coming. I think Greek people, I don't know if Greek food's ever going to catch the world's imagination the way that Italian has, even though, in my opinion, if I had a choice, I'd eat Greek, number one cuisine. Of course, most in my experience of 20, you know, something years going, most young people seem to prefer meals consisting of Nescafe and cigarettes more than almost anything.
Right. Well, Nescafe has kind of faded a bit as
has it?
Nescafe was the alternative to Greek coffee. So if you didn't want that really strong, powerful burst of Greek coffee, you would drink Nescafe, or you would make what they call the frappe.
Nescafe frappe, yeah.
It is certainly surprising to me how much kind of cappuccino culture has caught on, and you see espresso and cappuccino available all over Greece, and even
gelato too.
Calamus. And gelatos, that's right. But and of course, you know, there are always these ironies with the Eataly's in Italy, or one of the things that people always associate with Greek food is saganaki.
Yeah.
The fried cheese that they put brandy on and light on fire. And that was invented in Chicago in Greektown.
I didn't know that.
That's right. And it finally made its way to Greece when lots of tourists apparently kept saying, you know, we want, you know, where's the saganaki? And people were like, what is the saganaki? one of the Greek restaurant owners in Chicago had come up with that one. But the point is, I think, as you said at the beginning, all of these traditions are changing and flexible, and the idea that pasta or tomatoes is an essential part of either Greek or Italian cuisine. Obviously, doesn't go back more than a couple hundred years.
No, there are things. Yeah, go ahead.
There are things, you know. I mean, it's interesting. There are certain things that that have long, long histories, like the funeral food that they make in Greece, called kolivo, is made. It's a kind of boiled wheat. Wheat berries that they flavor with nuts and sometimes pomegranate seeds and sugar and all kinds of other things. And this apparently has existed in one form or another in Greece and I think in other Balkan regions for something like 3,000 years. So I don't want to deny that there's any kind of long-term continuity, but in some ways that doesn't even make kolivo somehow more authentic. I mean, people feel that, you know, tomatoes and beans are the Greek dish, and they are. Beans with tomatoes is very
well,
much...
Well, but yes, this is a whole other thing about why can't you get good gigantes in America? The question is, you're studying, or you teach at Southern Illinois University.
Mm-hmm.
Where do you get good Greek food around there?
when I decide to make it.
Mm.
Yeah.
Where do you shop?
Well, they have, of course, as in all kind of medium-sized towns, they have an international store that carries all kinds of things. They even used to, and one of the things that kind of takes me back to Kalymnos the most is these dried bread. They call them rusks. They're basically loaves of bread that have been cut up and dried out in the oven until they're kind of totally.
Yeah, it's like a Melba toast, sort of.
They have it like that, but these ones are kind of more big and dense and they kind of break your teeth when you eat them. And sometimes on Kalymnos, they would actually put that in a Greek salad. They would kind of put some water on it to soften it and make that part of a Greek salad instead of necessarily just using white bread to sop up the olive oil. And so to me, the flavor of that and maybe some Greek coffee and a dried fig just takes me back to Kalymnos more than anything else. And they used to carry that at this international store because they would go up to Chicago and get it. But apparently I was the only person who was buying these things. And so they stopped carrying them. And now I have to go when I visit my mother in New York. I go to Astoria and I buy a couple of bags and drag them back on the plane with me.
For me, it's any kind of retsina.
Mm. And retsina, of course, is something that is so horrible when you first taste it, and then you come to love it.
You took the words out of my mouth. That's what I tell everybody the same. They go, "What the hell is this?" And then you're like, and then for me, I take one sip, and I'm just like sitting, waiting for a ferry on a Greek summer.
That's right.
Afternoon and
that's right.
Me right there.
Because the flavor of the pine resin is so strong that one trick if you ever try Ritzina on your friends again is just tell them after they take a sip that they should exhale, and that cuts the pine flavor down so that it becomes tolerable for somebody who's not used to it. And so if you just exhale after your sip, you can kind of enjoy retsina at first. And then you start to get used to it, and then you come to want that flavor. But that's my tip. There are no recipes in this book, by the way. There are the videos, but there is that tip. And in fact, that's one other thing that I wanted to mention, which is that one of the things that I learned from the Kalymnians is that cooking is certainly not about kind of following recipes, but it's also not about kind of having the exact right ingredients or the best cooking tools. Certainly people didn't put any kind of stock in getting the best tools or anything like that, but is knowing how to work with your environment, with the tools you have, with the ingredients you have, and with the stock of knowledge of different tricks and different techniques that you have, that you've collected over your lifetime to produce something tasty. And so that's what I always try and carry with me, to that sense of a kind of practical engagement, caring about the food, spending enough time on the food, but not trying, as we said before, not trying to get it perfect, and not trying to kind of create some perfect environment around you, but just working with what you have.
Pleasure talking to you. I could talk Greek food, and I think you and I share a lot of the same philosophy and tastes. So, again, this is Professor David Sutton, Professor of Anthropology at Southern Illinois University. We've been talking about his book, Secrets from the Greek Kitchen. I'm Alan Salkin. This is New Books in Food. I'm also the new expert on About.com's cooking and food writing site, which is cooking.about.com. And I'm probably going to write a little spiel about this interview for the About.com site. New Books in Food is part of the New Books Network, which is an amazing thing piloted by our ultimate admiral, Marshall Poe, who deserves a ton of credit for this beautiful creation. So until I get around to talking to another fascinating food person, thanks for listening.
And thanks so much for having me, Alan.
Pleasure. This is New Books in Food, part of the New Books Network at newbooksnetwork.com, where there are interviews with authors on every subject you can imagine. It's a great site. Check it out. I'm Alan Salkin.